kind of felt a bit real tense. And we were looking at the sort of organisations, and you've put in how the Eastern District Headquarters and the Director of Royal Artillery, the gunner line thing. Well, I'm not quite certain where the Northern Command fits into this, and I think off tape you were just about to say that they were going.
Well, as part of the reorganisation of the Territorial Army, there was a reorganisation also of the old command structure, and they brought in United Kingdom Land Forces headquarters at Wilton, I think, as the overall command structure. And then they had district headquarters rather than commands. So it was all in the melting pot at the time.
Now, you mentioned that you had support from the gunner line and the district, the director of Royal Artillery.
Yeah.
Do you remember who that was and how they gave that support?
No. James Gunn might be able to remember who was the DRA at that time. I don't think it was Peter Foster. I think he was a CRA commander of Royal Artillery who would report to the director. But I may be wrong.
And how exactly did the DRA give support? Or was it sort of over dinners and almost informally?
No, not really. I mean, he had a power of command over the gunners as a commander of Royal Artillery. And he was probably tasked with the job of finding an effective role for us within the gunner organisation.
There was there being a recognition that your current role was not realistic or feasible in a long term manner. Home did this. Home,
I mean, they realised at this time that they'd actually converted the AVR3 regiments into carders of a few names of people, and it said here in April 68 that the government decided that no more effort was to be put into civil defence. The effect on AVR3 units was no soldiers to be discharged, recruiting could continue, there would be no pay or training allowances, and no camps would be held in 1968 unless the units wished to go to camp at no expense to the army, and that is why.
Well, so you were an AVR3 unit.
Yes.
So you'd been given this home defence role in the first sort of tranche of reforms, and then this second layer took away even that status and was reducing you to a cadre. So you were meant to be going right down to next to nothing.
Yeah, but I mean the whole thing was totally unrealistic, wasn't it? Because I mean, If this is correct, and I have no reason to believe it isn't correct, this is in fact exactly what we did. It said no soldiers be discharged, recruiting could continue, but without pay or training expenses, and no camps to be held unless TA units wished to go to camp at no expense to the army. I mean, it was a farcical situation. I mean, you couldn't have created anything more ridiculous if you'd have tried. Because what were they trying to achieve? They realised they didn't want any home defence regiments, but they hadn't thought out what they were going to do ultimately with what they got.
Do you think they were deliberately forcing you against the wall so that units would fold? Because
I think some did. Yeah. I mean, it was a farcical situation. I mean,
so this when you were converted into a cadre, you didn't actually sack everybody.
No,
everybody continued, but they weren't
getting recruit as well.
But you couldn't get paid.
No,
was there no pay of allowances at all?
No,
for attending drill night or
no.
So how did your men react to this?
I mean, we did obviously lose quite a lot. We wanted to keep the enthusiasm going, and I think we were of the view that if this was a farcical situation which we had, government hadn't thought it through, but they hadn't actually killed it stone dead, otherwise they wouldn't have allowed you to recruit more soldiers. In the sense of recruiting, we recruit someone, you've got to give them a uniform, so we were using army facilities and equipment, if you like, in a roundabout way. And we a lot of the soldiers went. If pay is important to territorial soldiers, I mean, a lot of people in the TA are unemployed, and they use it as a method of supplementing their unemployment pay. So, I mean, we did lose an awful lot, but we decided to have a go at a camp, and we raised money from industry and officers.
So, when you say you lost a lot, what proportion did you lose? I mean,
I think we probably lost a third straight away. People just fell by the wayside and disappeared.
So that would bring you down to about 320, from 400 to 320-ish.
Yeah.
Did you start trying to, did you continue to try and recruit, was that your response, that to reorganise the camp and to recruit as a colonel? Well, I mean, what did you try and do?
Well, I tried to keep the thing together, hoping that something would turn up at the end of the day and a role would be found for us, which it subsequently was.
Now, how did you, as colonel, try and keep things going?
I don't really remember. Except we tried to... There was a great loyalty to the South Knots Hussars by a large number of senior NCOs and indeed junior NCOs and soldiers who enjoyed coming to the drill hall, who enjoyed weekend training, and who would continue to do it without pay for a period of time. I mean, it would have been unrealistic, totally unrealistic, to have said they will continue to do it for the next 10 years, but. With the thought that somebody behind the scenes was working on a possible plan to save the situation, a large number of them continued to appear. I don't suppose we had, in those days, the numbers continuing on a Tuesday or on a Wednesday night to come on the weekends, but they kept enough together to have a camp of approximately 100 people.
Now, before we go to that, what would you do on the training nights? Because that's one thing I thought... I just wonder what exactly you had to do. You know, you had very little direct role on it.
Well, I believe that we still kept a certain amount of equipment. I don't believe that everything just disappeared. It was left in the drill hall.
So they didn't take the £25 off you?
Yes, the £25 had gone the previous year because when we became AVR3 we didn't require £25, so they'd gone. But we had some vehicles, we had some load-carrying vehicles, and we could get hold of load carrying vehicles if we wanted to from other TA units who were not AVR3. I mean, the signals regiment was extremely good to us at that period of time. We rent us vehicles and drivers if we wanted to go on exercise, if we wanted to go on a, if you like, a escape from invasion exercise on somebody else's private land, they lent us some vehicles to get us out there. And they were extremely good, and the signals squadron moved into the drill call, which we had exclusively before that. And so we were all in the TA, we're all great friends, and the squadron commander at that time, Roy Leder, was very helpful. And
this is the signal squadron.
Yeah.
Now, what did you actually do on a drill night? I mean, when you know. I mean, there was no gun drill to do. What about, was it signals and driving? Or?
I think there was just a certain amount of drill with small arms. Signals we had, I'm sure we had wirelesses at that time. And I can't really remember what else we did. I think, quite frankly, we did a fair amount of socialising in the canteen. Happy.
Now, the financing of the camp, there's something in the history about the formation of an adventure thing, or it's got a name for a fund you seem to have formed it before the time of the camp.
We formed what was called the South Knots Hussars Welfare Fund, which was real, and it's still in existence as a fund with charitable status. And it was a fund which was financed with a major donation from Tom Form and Hardy of £1,000. And approximately £1,000 was also produced from individual donations from ex-officers, employers who were very sympathetic to the cause, who we know well, and we decided that we would go to the club for 1 week's training with a joint officers and sergeants mess and another ranks mess. And we did infantry training over the Walcott ranges, and we managed to acquire some ammunition.
Infantry ammunition.
Ammunition. We managed to put together a number of vehicles to carry us about. We gave all the men, I think it was £5 pocket money for the week, and we ran the messes ourselves, and I think we borrowed some cooks from somewhere. We managed to put some food on the table, and everybody seemed to be quite happy, and it was quite an enjoyable week.
You had essentially, you were down to about 300, and a third of them went. Now, how many would you normally expect to go to a camp?
You would normally expect about 75% to go to a camp.
So obviously about another 100 didn't go that would have normally gone, or you know, something a bit more perhaps. But do you think the camp was worthwhile?
Yes, because we had visitors, including the general Slaughter Walker, Foster, and I'm sure we had others as well, who came to see this rather strange animal, which was the South North Czars, known as Featherby's Private Army, in Campbell Walcott.
So
we had a splendid luncheon party with the General and with Peter Foster, Sergeant Major Jack Dennis, and other officers, and other sergeant majors in the mess, and it just showed the ability of the Southern officers to survive in difficult circumstances.
So, in a sense, it wasn't so much the training you did at the camp that was important, but the fact that you'd done it, that you'd shown a determination.
I don't think anybody learns anything really from that camp other than how to run a public relations exercise. No doubt some of the boys had a good time with a rifle for the first time in their lives, but there was a great limited things we could do.
So it was a public relations exercise, to use it.
That's right.
Did any other units that you were aware of, cadre units, do this?
I don't know. I can't think of any that did, but it's possible that they did it somewhere else in the country, I'm sure, perhaps on other regions.
Could you have afforded it without Foreman Hardy? Because he seems to have given at least half the money that was available.
It was a very generous gesture on his part, and I don't know whether we could or we couldn't have done it. We would certainly have been in great difficulty if we hadn't have done it.
So it was an important thing, that donation.
It was,
I mean.
Yes.
Now,
we didn't use over £2,000. In fact, the basis of that fund is still in existence and has built itself up to quite a reasonable sum by now.
So you were on this. What else was going on? You had your meeting. This is where the famous meeting happened. Well, not famous. The meeting you had with the CRA and the general, and then afterwards you wrote the letter, which is better known, which we've already discussed. Now. Then how long was it before they announced what was to happen? I mean, was it a sort of tense period? Or did you just turn your attention to recruitment and sort of in the waiting period?
I don't know if you would agree, we'd certainly be recruiting, because I was fairly optimistic that something would have come out of this and we wanted to keep the strength up.
strength is absolutely vital in these circumstances, because if it drops below a viable level, it's so much easier for the Ministry of Defence or whoever it is that's making the decision to say they're no longer a viable organisation, get rid of them, and let's concentrate on somebody who is. So I would have been recruiting at that time, and we just presumably went through the winter hoping for good news, which would appear to have come in March.
Now, was recruitment getting more difficult? Because there's a perception that the 60s were at times of long hair, not hooligans, but you know, the there was a sort of modern pop music style cult coming for young people. Did that have any effect, or was it just an illusion? People were just pretty much the same as they were.
I think we managed to find this all, because our record proves that we did. They weren't particularly long haired. They may not have been all that practically intelligent, some of them, but they certainly are more like, they were good lads at the end of the day, and we kept them for a reasonable period of time. And turnover in the TA is always about a third anyway.
Did you have any new methods or sources of recruitment that you used in this? It was quite a desperate time. You had to keep your numbers up, as you said.
I don't think we had anything new. The old tribe and methods of going out on the market squares, or going to Huckle Market or Nottingham Marketplace, and perhaps encourage your existing soldiers to bring a friend in. Those are the methods that we always use. There's nothing novel about it.
Can we just look at some of the people you had? We've discussed there's Paul Pollitt, who's your second in command. And then the adjutant was a Captain A.G. Coward, unfortunate name in some ways.
Yeah.
What was he like? What was he like?
He was a good lad, had a regular gunner. He made colonel eventually.
And the quartermaster's not in, but RMO was, which I'm not sure what that stands for, was the Major Jay Hunting.
Yeah, that was a medical officer.
So they've had pretty much the same roles as before. 425 Battery, Major Keys, and with the trusty Warrant Officer Jack Dennis, I presume.
Yeah.
What was Major Keys like? Could you give us a few pointers to him?
He was very efficient, and be careful what I say, actually. I think he was probably our first choice for battery commander at the new OP battery, because of his abilities.
He'd taken over from Bream, had he? Roland Bream.
Yes. He decided at that point in time to leave the TA.
Do you know why?
His wife got at him, I think. You're going to speak to him anyway, so why not ask him why he left? I think he would probably say he was offered the battery and decided not to have it.
And that would be a fairly accurate. I mean, it may not have been a formal offer, but it was intended.
I think we had all decided of the battery commanders that the first choice was John Keyes.
Is there any truth? I mean, it almost seems that 425 Battery seemed to have the best gunner. I mean, they'd won the Queen's Cup. Was there a tradition that 425 Battery was better at gunnery than 426 Battery, or is that not?
I would like to think so. I'd train them. But I don't know. You're right, actually, historically, if you look at it from that point of view. I suppose that the star terms came out of 425. Having said that, of course, they did have this magical guy,
was he not suitable to become an officer? If he was so good, because you've mentioned him before, and I must admit that Colonel Gunn has mentioned him as well and said how good he was, and that he had an almost crucial role in the quality of 425. I mean, was a man like that not have some role as an officer, or had he reached his ceiling? Or
well, he was senior officer in the Sergeant's Mess as well, obviously, in a sense, and I think he rather enjoyed his rather special position in the regiment as a Sergeant Major, and the senior TA NCO in the regiment.
So he was happy enough where he was. You've already said that you were looking for NCO, for people. They had this officer cadet scheme going.
Yeah.
So there was nothing to stop him becoming an officer.
If he'd have kind of suggested to us that he might like to be commissioned, I'm sure James would agree with me that. We would have commissioned him. He was very happy. I mean, he'd soldiered with the Staff Officer last year in the war, had been on D-Day plus two or something, with a 25-pounder. And he liked to be what he was and thoroughly enjoyed it.
Now, 426 Battery, Major Jay Robinson? John Robinson?
John Robinson, yeah.
What was he like?
John? Very enthusiastic, very fit. Sometimes we wondered whether he was a gunner or an infanteer because he liked to kind of march over the hills and get dirty and all the rest of it. Still about, still very, very supportive of the South Officers.
And what about his warrant officer was, I presume, Battery Sergeant Major G. White. I don't know what G stands for.
Yeah.
George.
Chalky.
Oh, Chalky. Yes, you mentioned him before. Sorry.
Yes, he was.
He was George.
He was, in fact, in 45 with Jack Dennis when I had them together.
And so he was another competent.
Yeah, he was an ex-regular soldier, ex-boy soldier as well.
Alan Bexon. He was 520 Battery.
Yes.
What was he like?
He was Sherwood Rangers. And he came to us and was commissioned with us and served quite a long time. His gunnery was okay. I wouldn't say it was 100%, but it was okay. And he was prepared to take the battery on.
And he had BSM Warrant Officer Battery Sergeant Major Tebbit.
Yes.
That's not Norman Tebbit of the
yes.
previous.
Yes.
Now he'd been in the Second World War.
Yes, he had.
Because we interviewed Tebbit. I mean, what was he like? I mean, he was very keen on regulars when I saw him. I mean, what was he like?
Oh, he was thoroughly competent. I mean, you know, he retained all his wartime experience and was very useful. And of course, he was getting a bit long in the tooth, particularly for infantry training and that kind of thing.
Was that a disadvantage? I mean, should he really have been put out or changed role to perhaps quartermaster or something? You know,
he probably was at that point when perhaps yes, he might have been pushed up the line a little bit.
Was he one of the last of the second? Because I'd actually discussed them going in the 50s, but I mean, here he is in 68, 66. You know. Were there many left?
I don't think he continued in the new battery setup, if I remember correctly. I think he went to that point in time.
Now, during this, moving aside from personnel, another policy you seem to have, according to the history done, is to try and strengthen your links with 1st RHJ. Not yours, the regiment's links with 1st RHJ. Could you explain what this was about?
Well, because of our honour title, because we fought in the desert with the 1st RHA, we have always been extremely close to them. But at times, 1st RHA go abroad, and I think perhaps this was due to them returning to England, and we wish to get a bit closer to them in view of the uncertainties which were occurring about our role. And secondly, of course, we would be wanting once again the first regiment to provide us with a training officer or adjutant, as the case may be.
So, was there anything? I mean, did you visit the regiment? Did they visit you, or what happened to?
There's always been a cross fertilisation of ideas, and also we've always put them up in our building while you send their recruiting team to Nottinghamshire, so there's always a close affiliation with them.
Now, you were. How were you enjoying being colonel? I mean, it sounds a daft question, but I mean, it's yes. quite a stressful time, but I mean...
Yes. It was a stressful time, but I mean, I was quite happy that at the end of the day in 1969, when I retired, that I had achieved the object of the exercise, and that was that it carried on. It carried on as a battery, and a gunner battery.
Was it... What sort of time input did you have to put in when you, you know, as colonel?
Because of the shortage, if you like, of permanent staff at the Well, I had to attend probably one or two mornings a week for an hour or so in order to keep the administration going in those ABR 3 days. And there was a drill night once a week, and about one weekend a month a training, and then August and most of September we shut down.
Did it put a pressure on your work, or I mean?
Well, I was self-employed, luckily. So I mean, if I didn't work in my practice, and I went to Bulwell, nobody was going to grumble about it. I was, you know.
Did it cause any extra stress on home life, or?
Yes, I mean, there's no doubt about it that it certainly was a bit of a problem at the time. And of course, now the commitment of a territorial soldier is much greater than it was in those days. And this is one of the reasons why we have difficulty in recruiting officers.
Now, how did your succession, how was that handled? I mean, what happened first? Because you had this new battery was going to be created, and then also there was the succession. How was that whole...
Well, as far as I was concerned, there wasn't a succession of colonels, because there were no colonels in the new one.
Sorry, yes, yeah.
And so the colonel, if you like, RHQ personnel, all dropped by the wayside, and the new battery was formed under Major Benson.
So they were still a cadre when you left them, when you ceased to be colonel?
I suspect that I left the day before the battery was reformed.
Did you feel that you'd done your job?
Yes.
And what about the selection of... the keys had dropped out of the running.
I mean, a number of people at that time decided that... They would go, and John Robinson retired and went to run. I think actually, now I've come to think about it, I think the Carders remained in force for a little bit longer, and I think John Robinson went and ran the Carder, which was, I think, only about 10 soldiers. How long they actually lasted before they were disbanded, I'm not certain. But the John Roberts will be able to tell you about that, so really something for you to ask him about the Carder system. I dropped by the wayside. The battery, the OP battery was formed, it was 307 OP battery, under Alan Bexon.
That's what it was called. It was called 307 OP battery, that's South Notts Arles.
Now, he will tell you to whom he was responsible from the gunner point of view.
You seem to have kept that RHA in there.
Well, that's a lot of time, you see. They can't take us away from it. Well, they've been trying, but they can't.
So were you happy with the idea of Bexon taking over from you? I mean,
Yes.
So you the battery was in good hands as far as you were concerned.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Now, what about yourself? You were standing down, and you were actually going to go on to do something else because you didn't actually leave the TA. You went on to yes. If you could explain the situation.
Well, the TA has an active list and a retired list, and I just went on to the retired list.